between the wisdom passed down by ancient healing traditions, anecdotal experience, and modern clinical trials, one thing is clear: mushrooms are medicinal powerhouses. And I finally found a brand, a product, a company that I feel really aligns with all of my research and understanding when it comes to the medicinal properties of mushrooms, and that is Alchemy Mushrooms. They grow their mushrooms in California on organic mushroom farms. They keep the whole mushroom in their supplements, and they actually blend mycelium and fruit body in their mushroom powders and capsules to give you the best of both worlds. You can learn more at Alchemy Mushrooms. That's A-L-C-H-E-M-I. AlchemyMushrooms.com. Use the discount code MushroomHour for 20% off your order. Alchemy with an I, Mushrooms.com. Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today we have the terrific opportunity to speak with Maurizio Montalti. Maurizio is a designer, researcher, educator, and entrepreneur. Working at the junction of design and biotech, he is one of those early pioneers committed to the study and development of wide-ranging mycelium-based technologies and products. Maurizio is chief mycelium officer, chairman, and co-founder of Skim, the biotechnology company developing innovative processes and products by unraveling the potential of mycelium as a key biofabrication agent and technology for application and use across different industries, as fundamentally rooted in the valorization of residual material streams by means of microbial fermentation. As a biotechnology company today, Skim serves in two verticals: Mogu, their biomaterials and products dedicated to interior design and architecture, and Afea, biomaterials and products dedicated to fashion, automotive industry, and more. Maurizio's work has been honored with multiple awards, widely featured in the global media, and exhibited worldwide in prestigious museums, galleries, and institutions, including the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Centre Pompidou in Paris, Design Museum in London, Triennale in Milano, Maxi in Rome, and MAC, the Museum of Applied Arts in Vienna, among others. Coming to us all the way from Italy, Maurizio, it's an honor to have you on the Mushroom Hour.
Wow, thank you very much, Darren, for this very generous introduction. It's a great honor for me to be here today with you.
Well, that's pretty humbling coming from someone who has a body of work like yourself, whose work I'm a huge fan of. So thank you very much for that. And, you know, to kick us off, because just from that introduction, you're doing so much interesting material you're working with, both literally and figuratively. So why don't you tell us, you know, some of that origin story, maybe how you got involved with fungal organisms, what got you interested in working with them as a material, you know, as much as you can tell that arc that led you to where you are today.
Very, very gladly. Now, it's a little bit of a long story, so I'll try to break it down to a short one. Now, it all starts actually from a fascination. It's a long-standing fascination for mushrooms. Perhaps it's something that all kids share, you know, the fact of being mesmerized by these incredible morphologies, shapes, colors. But it didn't really have, for me, the chance to develop much farther until my late 20s, this type of fascination. As in fact, that happened during my studies. And I have a little bit of a mixed background. In a previous life, I started, I actually studied engineering, despite the fact that that was not exactly my cup of tea. And my real passion at the time was more based on, let's say, creative-oriented practices. I was very fascinated by design. However, I was in the middle of my engineering studies, and I terminated those studies. While studying engineering, I had the chance to study design as a self-taught designer, let's say, studying with my friends at the time that were just going for their degrees. And based on that trajectory, I developed different projects with which I had the chance to apply to a range of international masters that I never thought I could ever access to. And eventually things turned right, and let's say my work got appreciated. And that brought me to study in the Netherlands, in Eindhoven at Design Academy. And I went there initially just because I was very much fascinated by the idea of being a designer, developing maybe not really industrial products, but limited collections embedded with lots of storytelling. And yet when I was there as part of this kind of dream that I was finally living, I started fully questioning the design practice itself. And I started feeling an enormous frustration about the materialities I was dealing with on a daily basis. And I started thinking about shifting my role of designer towards, let's say, other destinations and investigating maybe not the most seductive topics usually within the design profession. And I'm here talking about a specific project where I was very much focusing on the notion of death and looking at death as a very beautiful and fundamentally complementary part of life. So touching upon what death represents in a very philosophical sense, if you will, but also at the same time reflecting upon the limitations from a cultural point of view that we experience, particularly in the Western society, but not only, when it comes to embracing death as this fundamental mean to regeneration, to transition. And in order to explore this subject, I felt the urge to deep dive into what happens out there, if it is out there, because it's also inside here. And let's call it nature. And questioning our very belonging to nature itself, you know, the fact that we keep creating this divide between the notions of culture and nature. And on the contrary, we must embrace the fact that human culture is an inherent part of nature and that through our culture and all that comes with it, we contribute to inform nature at all times. So let's call it a generative interdependence, or let's say this kind of re-evolution that I'm here calling for is essentially something driven by this notion of symbiosis, of deep cooperation among living systems. And at the time I was looking at how we are keeping neglecting even the passing of our human organic remains and how processes of decomposition take place in nature. Well, of course, our Western culture tends to very much deny this passing and this transformation of our beautiful containers that we call bodies. And in fact, we just fill the bodies with chemicals. We dress them up like going to theater. We are filled with grief, and that's very normal, and probably that will never change. But let's say that all such funerary practices strengthen this feeling of denial, and particularly prevent an effective reconnection with the natural cycles. And yet there were other subjects that were related to the way in which our bodies are fully toxified due to our lifestyle, due to the environmental conditions where we live. And so I'm basically saying all those different pieces of information, I'm mentioning those simply because it became quite a revelation when I started deep diving into who are the main agents in nature that are responsible for undergoing cycles of transformation and recycling of all types of compounds, organic and inorganic. And fungi are certainly one of the most fundamental main protagonists, the big stars. And so that's where my interest to learn more about this incredible kingdom started unraveling with its full potential. And I started knocking at so many different doors, talking about kind of scientific community, university, private labs, and so on. And it was particularly hard to gather some trust at the beginning. You know, the creative has always looked at with some sort of skepticism. Until I found somebody that was extremely generous and since then became a longstanding collaborator. We're still working together these days, a professor from Utrecht University, Professor Han Vosten, who decided to listen to my story and opened up the doors of his lab, allowing for me to encounter competent experts to inquire about things I was curious about. Of course, I pre-documented always myself, being passionate about reading scientific literature and such, but I didn't understand too much at the time, to be completely honest with you. And then finally, I could also start experimenting with cultures, with living cultures as living agents and as potential materials too. And that was quite groundbreaking, simply because I couldn't have afforded anything like that on my own, considering my student life. And yeah, that was a little bit of a moment of transition, let's say, that opened up this spiraling vortex that captures you and doesn't release you. And the more you deep dive, the more it expands and it keeps you highly fascinated. So let's say that was yet another uncertified degree, a kind of, let's say, education that I received without a formal paper at the end, that allowed me also to start gathering different type of scientific notions related to microbiology, to mycology, also applied knowledge in relation to techniques and processes, but particularly that allowed me to start creating an effective dialogue with members of other communities beyond design, beyond the creative practice, and therefore right. connecting all those different fields of expertise at the time also very much as a transdisciplinary translator, interpreter that could render some sort of complex information more accessible also to other audiences, included the general audience towards which I wanted to open up and democratize scientific information that too often stays confined within the borders of the lab or of the ivory tower of science.
I mean, it's just a beautiful story. And out of that, I'm struck by how many times innovators, especially in this field of mycelium materials, maybe this is no accident, and this is something that we're all too well aware of, where kind of artists and creatives are the ones that first take these novel ideas and just try them. And they have to be transdisciplinary. They have to communicate insights from many different fields of study, combine them, work with the organism or the medium into a place that brings these ideas or these principles into reality. It just seems like though with every mycelium material related person that I meet and have a chance to speak with, they have some element of that story of they were an artist, they were a creative, they wanted to make sculptures out of mycelium. There's always some track that brought them to fungus and working with mycelium as a material related to art and creativity. So it's not shocking to hear that in your story, but I think it is a beautiful story of kind of how you got there.
What I think is also interesting is, on my end, it really didn't start based on the interest of creating materials. That was not the goal. Actually, right. At the beginning, it was much more of a provocation, of a kind of critical statement towards the design field, whereas I didn't want to be the designer introducing more products in the market for the sake of just yet another product. On the contrary, I was working for some sort of designing away perspective to emerge. So I wanted
designing
to
deconstruct things.
Exactly. Yeah. I was working with fungi to degrade materials, to degrade products. So I started from the body, working on this project that was about basically a shroud made out of mycelium, inoculated with mycelium that was contributing to degrade the outer layers of the body, detoxifying all the different compounds that we incorporate during our lifetime, including heavy metals and so on. So it was conceptual, and yet it was part of a study conducted in the lab, so very much based on a scientific truth. And then I extended towards synthetic products, looking at fungi that could break down different types of polymeric compounds, like synthetic polymers deriving from extractive processes, very long-lasting matters. And so really always resonating with this kind of environmental drive that, as since I know myself a little better, being part of myself, and the fact of willing to contribute in a way that could possibly improve the situation we are still experiencing today in a very disgraceful manner when it comes to our impact on the ecosystem we are part of. And then only at a later stage, the more I was degrading stuff, the more I kept witnessing the generation of yet another material. You know, nothing is created, nothing is destroyed, everything is transformed. And fungi are these masters of morphing, this master of transformation, or even better, of transmutation, talking in alchemical terms. And in fact, it was amazing to see that as much as I was degrading whatever organic or inorganic compound, I was obtaining increasing amounts of organic fungal biomass. And from that intuition, the interest in developing new materials and in studying, investigating processes that could come to the advent of materials that could possibly be seen as alternative to traditional synthetics started emerging in a more pronounced way. And I started increasingly focusing on that, yes.
Yeah, well, and it's almost like you move up in that stream of production. You kind of move upstream and think, okay, I may never be able to degrade the endless tide of junk being shoved at us, but maybe if I can actually use a different material in the initial creation of all this stuff, and I can't call it junk. Some of this is stuff that makes our lives better and all that caveat in there, but to move upstream and think, okay, if I can make these out of material that is more regenerative, easier to break down kind of along the length of its life, this will have a bigger impact than endlessly trying to keep up to degrade things. And in working with it as material, where did you start? Because we talked about, you know, the two kind of initiatives now that SKIM has in place, where kind of the fashion, the architectural, but where did your interest start when that switch flipped? Did you get more interested in maybe making some kind of building material, or did you kind of want to dive into all of it? Kind of where did you start in mycelium materials?
So I think it was 2011 when at the studio level, so I'm running also, it all started from my Amsterdam-based practice called Officina Corpuscoli, literally the workshop where you work with the little bodies. That's the name in Italian. And basically, as part of my practice, which is rather experimental and design research driven, I started creating, let's say, an exemplary collection of limited pieces in this case that were just emerging from the processes I was cultivating, literally, in the lab. And it ended up being a collection of plates, of bowls, of tiles, of different types of vessels, which were not there necessarily to be seen as objects of utility, but were reminding of that potential application. They were more sculptural objects. Some of them are also here behind me, and it's like old prototypes and things like that. And I was fortunate enough to gather attention, and the project became rather popular. And all of a sudden, a new frustration kicked in, because, of course, I was very gratified. You know, my ego was very gratified by the fact that people were fond of the new paradigm that I was predicating about, you know, this idea of shifting from an extractive, exploitative paradigm to a generative paradigm based on growth, based on cultivation, literal cultivation, where matter could be generated by feeding the organisms, microbial cultures, with residual compounds from other value chains, the agro industry, the manufacturing industry, and so on and so forth. But yet it became so self-referential because, of course, these beautiful conversations kept happening within the cultural space only, mostly, meaning being in a continuous and great exchange with the cultural elite, maybe less than 1% of the global population. And I kept going around speaking about impact and change. And yet my stuff was exhibited in illustrious museums and galleries. And yes, great. I really appreciate that. Of course I do. But that was not sufficient. And from there, there was this kind of drive of saying, okay, I need to be coherent with my story, and I really would like to try and contribute to that impact. And so my life became a little bit more complicated when I decided, together with some colleagues and today business partners, to incorporate this company, Mogu, in 2015. And the objective there was the one of scaling up and actually standardizing the very presumptuous human approach, no? Biological processes for the creation of stable products that could satisfy the industry demand and so on. And the first years were just years of research to identify, again, how to standardize a certain protocol and to obtain emergent properties in the final material, starting from the biology. So functionalizing the material, starting from all the complex matrix of parameters that you need to manage, ranging from the type of fungus you work with, to the substrate, the feedstock itself, to the environmental conditions, and so on and so forth. And at some point, we came to realize that we obtained a very solid protocol where we could express a very specific porosity, starting from the biofabrication-based process of mycelium growing through a complex matrix of whichever type of substrate. And we started measuring our materials. We were already doing it since a while, and we started noticing this constant property that was quite a good and efficient capacity of our materials to absorb sound when it comes to the frequencies of speech in the interior environments. So we went down that route after having hypothesized about many different applications. We listened to the material. We observed and listened to the material in order to inform the first applications that we came out with, and that was in 2019, where we released our first line of products, commercially available products, which was the beginning of the Mogu Acoustic Collection, which is today a commercial reality. And at the same time, I really want to highlight that these are, in fact, products. Yeah. And I say that simply to respond to, unfortunately, the great confusion we experience today out there when it comes to an enormous amount of claims of wannabe products that are not yet at the level of market, either because of the standard they have not reached or of the volume that is provided, rather than, and that's the most important part, of the certifications that they require in order to be commercialized, which was for us also a lot of commitment. You know, the fact of needing to have, particularly being in Europe, there's quite a stringent framework when it comes to rules and regulations, and you need to comply to a lot of things.
Yeah, especially working with biological organisms, trying to have some kind of standardization to have a product available for commercial scale. And, you know, I just love the ethos there that you guys listened to the organism first. You know, that could have been years of market research to think, well, people need, you know, chairs or people need this product. We are now going to try to identify and figure out how to make this product. And I love that you guys started from the organismal side to say, okay, we're just going to start working with various different fungal species and genera, and we're going to figure out what they make best in terms of how they could create a product. We're going to listen to the organism. I think that that's a departure from some other companies.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really, I mean, it's of course a combination of aspects, but definitely we were led by this process of attentive observation and listening. Plus, it's right what you say, we have been screening an enormous amount of genera and, well, let it be species rather than strains. And of course, we were also driven by the performance, let's call it that way, that each single agent, each single actor that we decided to partner with was expressing. And this, of course, relates to multiple aspects. It could be the vegetative growth speed rather than the capacity of certain fungus in certain conditions to create specific type of structures or to grow its area life in stacks with a certain density within a relatively short time frame. But then it's always this matter, it's always interesting because it's about this striving for optimizing processes and making them efficient, which I find quite ridiculous at times, despite the fact that it's fundamentally needed when you work in industry. But of course, that very much collides with the values that animated my drive at the very beginning, whereas what I cherish, what I nurture, is an expectancy, is total serendipity, is the value of imperfection, is the, so beyond standardization, it's appreciating what the process allows you to experience for what it is without trying to be that much in control as much as you try to in industry, which is an important, maybe it's an interesting subject also to further reflect on. And yeah, so it's quite interesting to reflect about the different dynamics that animate this type of work, whether it's placed within a more open framework, within a more explorative relation of the active collaboration between two living entities, or more than two, perhaps, let's say two domains, let's say the human species and the non-human agent, the fungal organism that you are deeply collaborating with. So to really to reflect about this notion of keen cooperation among species that might seem so far from one another, but that in fact fundamentally need each other to allow, or at least maybe we need them, to allow for our existence, as opposed to a practice, the industrial one, that easily strives for dominion and total control over processes, possibly often neglecting the agency of the very actors that allow for a certain process to come into being, say the fungi being able to create a material, and ending up easily to become yet again another exploitative practice. And that is, of course, something that I am very strongly trying and so far succeeding to prevent as part of my industrial activities.
Well, and you find a lot of times with individuals who are innovative or highly creative, trying to, and I can't take credit for this idea because I heard it elucidated recently, where they tend to get comfortable with and then thrive in paradox. And in hearing your story, you wanted to work with organisms we associate with death, but you wanted to use them to be regenerative and build life. And then on this side, you know, you're trying to collaborate with these organisms as much as you can on their terms, up against the giant machine that is industry, and the paradox there of trying to balance those two interests. And as you're able to successfully negotiate that, you kind of find success and innovation. It's really interesting to think about that, that concept of paradox, and how if you can live in that and get comfortable in that, what grows out of those relationships.
And absolutely,
you know, you talked about another paradox, the idea where the infinitude of biology represented by the kingdom or queendom of fungi is directly opposed to my immediate desire when you started talking about it to standardize, to create a grid and figure out how do we assess each different type of fungal species with each environmental condition. I mean, already there's infinite variables, even if you're just working with a couple fungi. So just as best you can, explain what that process is like. I mean, because I would imagine you need to bring these cultures to fruit. It'd be one thing just to have thousands of petri dishes trying these experiments, but you actually have to bring these to fruit and then analyze them. I'm fascinated by that R&D process of trying to standardize and really make your own scale, codify your own processes, and then much less, you know, figure out what features you're looking for. You know, you kind of have to make your own scale of, yeah, is this something that is easy to grow? So this is good for our production environment, but it doesn't really have the material capacity we need. So what was that process like, I guess, the R&D? Maybe we can start with your fungal selection process and how you figured out what parameters to even, what variables to even tweak along the way.
Right. That's a constantly ongoing process, despite the fact of being a little presumptuous and thinking that we know much today. In fact, we are kind of relatively proud of what we do and what we learn to do, but we know that we are just scratching the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
At the same time, now, it all started from existing organisms at the beginning of my practice, commercially available organisms that I either sourced at the time from the lab where I was working, and here we are talking about model organisms, usually badly defined as scientific workhorses, which makes me shiver only to think about it. And on the other hand, there were strains that were coming more from the mushroom farming world, as that was another very fundamental way for me to learn also on a more macro level about the nature of certain processes. I basically did my spontaneous internships at the farmers, and I started working with them in order to understand how these things came about. And so they were a little bit the usual suspects. I mean, on a more fundamental level, we were working with the mother organisms such as Schizophyllum commune, very widespread fungus to be found all over the world, the split peel mushroom, that is actually quite an interesting one for many other features it has, but I can perhaps refer to that also later on. And on the other hand, if I think about the mushroom farming world, there were the usual Pleurotus species, rather than Ganodermas when it comes to medicinals, rather than turkey tail, Trametis versicolor, and so on and so forth. And these were the main protagonists at the beginning. So it became, it quickly, the matrix quickly became more complex, not only because I started sourcing a lot of organisms from bank collections, from friends, and so on, and studying their behavior just on Petri dish and on a kind of standard medium. So not even working with complex substrates, but trying and be quite keen in keeping the variability of parameters as limited as possible. But also because I started becoming a very eager collector of specimens from out there, from nature, from everything we are immersed in. And the collection multiplied exponentially very quickly. And it was really difficult for me at the beginning as an individual to stay behind that all and to also interpolate all kinds of observations and data. It was way too much. Yeah. When we started scaling up with Mogu, we luckily had already developed a little bit of a maturity when it comes to the to some species. Now, one, it's very much of an assumption that is not proven scientifically, but if you think about the wheel of creating a material that needs to have, for instance, a certain stiffness, imagine, you might want to focus on fungi that produce fruiting bodies, which are more in the realm of, let's say, the wood-like kind of mushrooms, you know, all the kind of polypores and the likes. That is perhaps a very banal and design-driven intuition that my scientific collaborators always said, well, you cannot say that. And it's like, of course, you cannot say that. However, in hindsight, you can, in fact, verify that this fungi tend to work very effectively when it comes to the production of a certain chemistry and of certain compounds at cell wall level, meaning that, in fact, they express the different glucans and the chitin in a way that is suitable to be evaluated and mastered and engineered according to the properties that you want to derive in a final material, knowing that the sugars inform, for instance, more the elasticity of the material, while the chitin, to say something very, very simple, tends to inform the stiffness and the rigidity and the tensile strength of a material. It's not so straightforward, but you start deriving all these type of intuitions and they drive your choice. And with that, there's also, when it comes to the selection of the species and of the strains, there's the capacity of a strain to grow with a certain speed. Of course, one thing is a fungus that has a vegetative growth cycle of 2 months versus one that grows in less than 2 weeks. And the amount of biomass that within the time frame is produced, and so on. And the color, the pigmentation, something that you want or that you don't want, because it allows to obtain a standard or rather not. So it's been a lot of parameters interpolated, but it was certainly not just about the fungus itself. That was a fundamental learning at the time, and the learning continues, but so many other parameters contribute to inform what the qualities of a material. Say, first and foremost, the feedstock. Let's imagine just whatever lignocellulosic biomass, it could be so any kind of plant matter, could be a long fiber, a short fiber, it could be soft, it could be hard, it could be oriented, it could be random, it could be a mix of more substrates. And what's the nutrient contents? Do they satisfy the requirements of that specific fungus? And every fungus is a universe on its own, as its own diet. Fungi can have up to 12% genetic difference within the same species, with strains that have the same name, and yet they have up to 12% genetic difference, when between man and ape there is 2%. Yeah. So it's just mind-blowing, the diversity and our lack of understanding and our presumptive approach in classifying them. If we consider that, in fact, I mean, also in terms of amount, there is an estimated 5 million plus species out there of which we know, and I quote know in the sense that we don't know, a 10% of them, meaning that we have partly described them scientifically. So we don't know anything. Yeah. And that is just mind-blowing. And that is part of the excitement, because it's such a continuous discovery. And you think you know, and in a Socrates fashion, the more you think you know, the more you realize you are absolutely at the starting point. And so there's all these parameters. There's the fungus, there's the substrate, there's the environmental conditions, temperature, humidity, gas exchange, pH, and so on and so forth. And once you start just driving each of these parameters and attentively study the influence of each one by one, you start deriving a model. And based on that model, you start building on your capacity to anticipate on the outcomes of a certain fermentation-based process with that specific strain.
Just what you laid out there about the infinity of potential within these organisms, it's almost like you have to deal with them on an individual basis, which is kind of impossible. And I always wonder, will humans be fluent enough or have the tools to really understand the differentiation between all these organisms? It runs, you know, so counter to our desire to just make general categories. I mean, fungi completely break out of that mold and totally defy categorization. And you just laid out about 12% genetic difference between them. I mean, how can we even, how do we understand species differences, genera differences, when there's that much variation within what we call a species? I mean, that's absolutely fascinating. And just hearing about the hints of what that process must be like for you, I mean, it would seem like figuring out that database, if you will, or that model is hugely valuable to any business that wants to do this, is deriving a model of, you know, parameters, modulation, and how it will affect a given strain.
Yeah, and yet you are always exposed to that surprise factor, because I mentioned the word presumption quite a few times. And in fact, we humans are a rather presumptuous species. And we pretend at some point to be in control, but biological processes are subjected to inherent variability. So no matter if you're going to repeat the same protocol with the same materials, living agents, and the same conditions, you would expect exactly the same outcome. And mostly often, but not always. So there's always that kind of autonomy within the process, that effective agency that the microorganism holds, that prevents you from being in total control. And I think that's a gigantic learning for the industry. And I think that the industry and human culture at large can derive a lot, can grow a lot out of this simple understanding, the fact of letting go, the fact of embracing collaboration for what it is and or what it should be. And that's why earlier on I was mentioning the concept, the notion of symbiosis, as introduced by Lee Margulis. And I think that's a very important notion, because what is, I'm sure that everybody listening to the Mushroom Hour knows very well about symbiosis, but just for the ones who might not, symbiosis is nothing else than that active process of entanglement through which nature evolves, as in its continuous becoming. And it's the very process that is at the origin of life on Earth. It's defined as the capacity of living agents of interacting with one another and establishing partnerships with others beyond their species to sustain their own life and to continue their legacy. And they do this through special forms of interaction, and they is also us. And in fact, we are walking biotope. We are whatever, we are a big mixture of many, many planets, many universes, many dimensions, many fundamental microbial agents that we hardly know that contribute to make us humans, among which also fungi, and certainly many bacteria that we carry in our guts, on our skin, and so on. So if we think about this also from an evolutionary perspective, if we think about how all things came together, if we think about fungi and their fundamental role, without fungi, the world as we know it would not exist at all. It's simply, I mean, fungi are the agents that create ecosystems. That no water at early stage, and these are theories, but to me are more facts than theory, could have moved from water to land if it would have not been for fungi. There would have not been forests to walk in if it wouldn't have been for fungi. Herbivores such as cows could not exist due to the lack of gut fungi that break down nutrition. Fermented drinks that we kind of feast on when we want to relax a little bit would not be there. And the list goes way longer. And also, as we've been talking now very briefly about evolution, the evolutionary context, we should also not forget that they are our biological ancestors, and that they have been around for much longer than we humans have been. As in fact, it is estimated the fungi emerged around 1 billion years ago, while plant emerged around 500 million years ago, and we humans barely, if I'm not wrong, 300,000 years ago. So there's a lot we have to learn, and they are there to teach us, if only we are eager to listen.
That's what's so interesting. As you were talking about that recently, I really had it reinforced, that worldview that this entire world we live on is just continual symbiosis with different groups of organisms. Yes, we are hollow bionts, these unstable masses of different organisms in symbiosis that makes up our vessel. You could say that about most biological life. And really these shifts, you know, these ecologies on down to individual kind of organismal levels, as we define it, all the way on up, define everything. So I think you said that way better than I just said, but I think you said that beautifully. And I'm struck by this process. And when these early days of really trying to work with mushrooms and fungi, it's almost a very intellectualized symbiotic process. I mean, these processes of symbiosis between fungi, plants, bacteria, animal are ongoing all the time without having to think about it. And it's so interesting that as human beings, we have this intellectualized symbiosis that we take a very measured approach, and we're having, meanwhile, inside of us, there are fungi in our gut that are doing their thing, whether we know it or not. And so much of human history is defined then by a kind of intentional symbiosis or unintentional, thinking about things like food, drink, that were basically accidental domestication of a species of fungus that didn't kill us when we ate or drink it, but instead had a good effect. So then we took those around and tried to take our little domesticated microorganisms and put them with other foodstuffs or other liquids to try to make that same process happen over and over again. But then to take it to the level we're at now, where your team is kind of measuring variables in as best you can, a standardized format, yeah, it's just an interesting concept to throw on top of symbiosis, which inherently seems like a very messy process of just things coming together, hitting up against each other, shooting chemicals at each other, figuring out how it can work together. And then you guys are embodying that same principle, but I want to say in a very intellectualized or a very kind of evolved type of symbiosis or a different type of symbiosis. It's a fascinating concept.
Yeah, and just to keep going on this line very briefly, I mean, there's, as we know, many types of symbiosis. Just to mention a few, mutualism could be one, parasitism could be another. And I always have fun when thinking it's about my narrative, my storytelling. Already back in the days, I always was thinking about, you know, this paradigm based on growth, on cultivation, again, valorization of residual resources. And I was talking about the cooperation, the active collaboration between myself, the designer, and the fungus. I used to say, well, I actually I'm not the designer. The fungus is the designer. And the parallel was, it's as if we are at a dance show. Now, I am the choreographer and fungi are the dancers, but well, without the dancers, there would be no show. And yet then I started thinking about it in time along the years, and I was like, that's so presumptuous once again, that you think you are the one in control telling fungi what to do. And here comes up the question of who is in control? Is it really you in control? Isn't it maybe the other way around? Quite like there might be a little bit of a plan that was elaborated much longer, much before you even started existing as a species, that brought us today to experience this incredible excitement that brings us to cooperate with fungi, where at times we are always, where I also feel a little bit doubtful about, I don't want to see this type of virtuous practice going towards an exploitation of this kingdom. And yet that might be part of the game, simply because, in fact, fungi are allowing through our actions and enthusiasm to further propagate themselves and to further infect, in the most positive way, the world we live in, both outside and inside. So I think it's quite interesting just to reflect. I have no certain answer about this, of course, but to reflect on this notion of control and who is in charge.
Who's domesticating who? Yeah, as I said that, are we domesticating the fungus or are they domesticating us? I had someone predict recently that there are more active yeast cells, Ascomycete yeast cells, alive on planet Earth in intentional cultivation by humans than there are stars in our galaxy. So it's just these like fascinating concepts we're playing with. And like I said, these processes you're working with, as measured as they seem, is just another version of this symbiosis, maybe a very intentional version, a very, you know, at the human conscious level, a very intentional version of the symbiosis. But this just continues on down the line. Another question I had is you talked about your collection, which is something I love. I love the idea of building a culture library of things you found in nature, things you picked up here and there. And before you know it, people are sending Maurizio weird fungi and look at this one. This one has a strange morphology, or how is it living here? And you're thinking, I want a sample of that. You know, we think of this idea as bioprospecting, which again has kind of an extractive connotation. I like to think of it kind of as observation and cultivating diversity. But when we think about this collecting of different cultures, finding odd, maybe individuals in the wild of a species that we thought we understood, how much of that do you think will work its way into this commercial or industrial space? I mean, do you think there will be strains or individuals of strains that will end up being mainstays in kind of the industrial production of mycelium materials? Do you think we'll end up sticking largely with species or strains that we've used for a long time in similar commercial applications? Oh, what are your thoughts there?
They already are. They already entered the commercial applications. Of course, there's some more well-known organisms out there that one can rely on, particularly for fundamental research reasons. Right. But if we look at the field of, as my dear friend Phil Ross called it back in the days, mycotecture or mycofabrication, let's put it that way, it's such a young discipline and hardly there is a standard. I mean, each of us working in this field, among which many of us are also friends, by the way, despite the fact of being competitors then in the whatever capitalist context, right, for whatever that matters. Has been working with the same foundational principles, and yet has been developing completely different things in terms of materials or products based on different processes, based on different strains. And most of these strains are not strains that were out there suitable for growing materials. They are found strains that have been studied and identified suitable for a process because of a certain property that they expressed, or a set of properties. In our case, if I think about, let me refer to the small and yet respectable collection that we have at the company at Scheme. We have to date, thanks also to the cooperation of our mycologists in the lab, who are extremely knowledgeable and passionate people that I'm always loving listening to, because I have to learn so much from them. They really can identify everything, and I would imagine. Love to have that skill. But I think we have put together around something more than 250 strains today of different species. And those are part of our internal bank. We conserve it in different places also to make sure that they do not mutate, that they keep always the same. But when I say we have a bank, it's not just we collect them with their own plate and there they go. No, we studied each of them. It takes a lot of dedication to do this. Of course, out of this, a fraction make it through the cut. And when I talk about a fraction, I'm really talking about a few. Today, for anything that is product related, we work with two main strains. And yeah, at the lab level, let's say, to be generous, 10 at the more research, applied research level. But of course, as said before, each of these agents have so much to say and need so much time to be thoroughly explored. And it's quite interesting, even when you think about the fact that, scientifically speaking, we are still working in such a limited way because we work finally with monocultures. Monoculture, it's a bad word. It is a bad word. But that's the only way that we have today to understand certain dynamics, to understand a certain language, to understand how these agents react to variations in environmental conditions or whatever other stress factors that may appear. For me, the most exciting part when it comes to research is really, though, to start deciphering increasingly more the nonverbal communication that takes place among different types of microbial kingdoms, because it's very limited what we do in the lab, studying the behavior of a single culture in a sterilized medium. It doesn't express the potential that could emerge from a thorough understanding of the interaction and of the molecular language that is spoken among different individuals as based on a co-culturing type of approach, where fungi, different species of fungi, bacteria, and whatever other organisms coexist in order to positively trigger each other and balance each other. Right. And I think that is really the ultimate aim, that though we are, generally speaking, also the scientific world still struggling with, simply because we do not yet have the capacity of deciphering what we could call, for instance, quorum sensing or whatever kind of molecular communication happening among microbial systems.
Yeah, it is the limitation of our Umwelt, the idea that we don't have the capacity to, our senses, our perceptions don't allow us necessarily to have as good an understanding of what these organisms are capable of. Do you see that kind of predictive capacity developing? It is such a new field. I could already see this ecosystem developing where you have folks dedicated to the research of strains, strictly researching different species. Then you have folks that are specialists in the actual cultivation. They have protocols to take one species and get potentially different materials out of just one species. And then you have people that are just providing the different substrates. And I can see this growing up really quickly, like we've seen in commercial, gourmet, and medicinal mushroom farming. But do you think we will get to that kind of predictive capacity where either through genetic markers or some other kind of analysis, we can start to take different species or individuals within a species and say, hey, we know how this is going to react to, let's just say, a food made of coconut husks versus rice, or we know how this will react to this much temperature. I mean, do you think that we can that we could get there in the future?
It is increasingly happening. It's already happening right now. Plenty needs to be unraveled still, and that process of unraveling, let's say, the responsibility for that to happen is in the hands of the many. It's not a single company or a single individual that can undergo such enormous, such massive task, but it's the collaboration among the many that can promote a quicker advancement in such field. And this is what we humans tend to fail dramatically in this. It's not our best skill, right? But things are moving. Things are moving on promisingly. And I think there is more than ever a renewed sensitivity towards the urgency of finding out more about, this complex matrix we were talking about, but also about the capacity of microbial beings to be in this world, in which way they express themselves beyond just our human-centered interpretations. And I think that level of sensitivity and deep analysis can be reached today, perhaps not yet fully through science, but through different types of experiences where you, in fact, can get in touch in direct communication with fungi, and you can effectively speak to them, and they can speak to you, and you better listen to them.
Wow, I love that. I love becoming fluent in the language of fungi through subtle energies or some other discipline. And again, I talked about being able to live in paradox and just thinking about how this emerging industry, as all things are changed by the environment, they change their environment. There's always that correspondence going on. It feels like the work that you're doing, Phil Ross, folks in this field who, you said it, who are quote unquote competing in the current ecosystem, economic ecosystem you're living in, but then your friends and collaborating. And maybe that is then changing some of that ecology, that economic ecology, by your actions of kind of sitting in that space, mimicking, listening to the organisms you're working with, seeing the need to collaborate in symbiosis with others, and then having these external pressures. Maybe that's causing some kind of shift. That would be my hope.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better than you did. And indeed, there is that intention. It's a little bit of a hidden agenda, but not so hidden either. I think it's really the what could sparkle from who contributed to found certain type of initiatives and to drive them. And yet when these individuals come from a certain space, a certain that provided the opportunity for a certain depth of thought that perhaps in industry, well, that's not exactly what is usually characterizing industry. There is a potential for that shift to happen in a more pronounced way, to be driven, if you keep patient enough and you resist to the continuous pressure that you're constantly subjected to as part of the everyday life within the capital-driven society.
Oh, I think we owe a debt of gratitude to you, kind of radical hyphy, you folks that go into that world to kind of express a different way of doing things and exploring novel concepts. I think that that loosens some of that economic tension, that capital-driven tension that allows it, makes it easier for others to kind of follow that path. So I think we definitely owe a debt of gratitude. And just going back then to Mogu, which is the first company we talked about, what are some future design ideas? Because we have the acoustic panels right now in production. What are some future design ideas you hope to develop then with Mogu?
Right. So today in production, there are a couple of lines. There's acoustic panels. There's resilient flooring tiles also that we developed. So actually, we are selling this stuff, and it's appreciated for high quality products that today are still a little bit that they are competing with market pricing, but they're still a bit in the premium segment. And that's not the reason for having started that. It's not about having a company producing luxury product. But of course, that's where you need to start, high added value type of applications in order to further scale and eventually be able, and that's the ultimate objective, to come to every single body to be able to afford such type of products and therefore truly make an impact. On the other hand, there's actually, we just released today, today was the date of release of a new product, the Pluma product, still part of the acoustic line, but also with a strong decorative component, a lot of playfulness when it comes to modularity and so on. So for anybody curious, you could have a look at that online on the mogu.bio website. But other applications when it comes to, let's say, the so-called, not a nice name, the green building sector, so solutions to interior design and interior architecture, is our solutions that relate to thermal insulation, something we've been studying for a long time that we didn't yet introduce in the market because we are finalizing our path for certification. Of course, it's fundamental to have such type of products fully certified and to make competitive with different kinds of problematic insulation materials that emit a lot of VOCs that are of mineral origin, are extractive materials and so on, as opposed to our materials or any kind of mycelium-based material, I would say, emitting close to zero volatile organic compounds and having an enormous amount of benefits. Actually, they emit less VOCs than wood. So wow. that's impressive. Amazing. Yeah. And more is to come. We have been also venturing and exploring potential applications for the construction industry. But of course, when it comes to more structural products, it's a very delicate matter, safety is at stake, so normatives must be respected. And it takes some time also to allow for the effective use of such materials, depending on the country. But let's say that this is a trajectory that needs a little bit more support also from policymakers, I would say. And that's not something you usually can rely upon. Certainly, you don't stay there waiting for that. And in the meantime, you better keep working. And at some point, that might happen. And it should. But again, keep the expectations low. That's always the best strategy. And at the same time, we are experimenting also at a more investigative level, let's say, on projects. We drive a lot of collaborative projects with both the public and the private sector. Besides our commercial activities, we run a lot of funded projects. In Europe, we have a scheme that used to be called Horizon 2020. It's a generous funding provided by the European Commission. That's actually how you exist in Europe. We wouldn't exist today if it wouldn't have been for that type of support. We don't have this great VC ecosystem at the early stage like it happens in other continents. And so that became a necessity at the early stage, but also it brought us to increasingly work with so many different stakeholders within so many different projects and value chains and so on. So to expand our network, to learn mutually from one another and so on. And one project that I'd like to mention is this FUNGAR, that stands for Fungal Architectures Project, where we are, it's a small consortium, where we are basically creating fungal architectures, very much based on monolithic structures grown from mycelium biomass and residual plant matter, but that are kept alive, as opposed to our products that are killed in order to be suitable for the market. They need to be inert. They shouldn't transform. We are scared about transformation. What's going to happen? Things transform. Oh, my God. And until we are not going to embrace that, I think we are just going towards being doomed. But besides this quick comment that I'm happy to expand on, if you like, it's an interesting project because it combines the skills of an advanced architecture department from a university in Copenhagen with the fungal expertise developed at fundamental level by Utrecht University, microbiology department, fungal biology in Utrecht. Our capacity to work with biomaterials and the work from a UK-based university that is expert in unconventional computing. So basically, we are working with the capability of fungi to compute. And therefore, we are working on living on the proof of concept of a small-scale living building that is not killed, but because of its living agency, it's capable, practically speaking, also of repairing itself. May a crack appear, it can self-heal. So it's a self-healing material when alive by means of autonomous bio-welding, if you want to put it that way. And on the other hand, the fungus is able to express, when subjected to stresses that relate to changes in environmental conditions, for instance, to change its morphology, to change color, to provide information about what's happening in the environment. And this is a rather high-risk experimental project, but I love to drive this type of projects because they really pave the way towards the vision that we are kind of pursuing. Of course, we are working in the now for satisfying the demands of today. But if you ask me, I'm not the biggest fan of partnering with my microbial actor. And once I achieve my goal to kill my microbial actor, as I think that everything that exists is meant to pass. And this obsession with eternity is our greatest limitation. So if we are able to program materials, thanks to the skills of fungi, to last for a specific amount of time within a specific applicative framework, and that living agency allows also for expressing so much more, because fungi are incredible computing, not machines, agents, living beings, not machines. They are so much more capable than any machine. I think we can unravel a much different future where coexistence drives the coevolution of all species. And perhaps we'll become a little bit like the Smurfs.
We become a little bit like the Smurfs. And that is, I mean, it just seems like, again, this is part of this process. You know, I was thinking as you were talking about that, about a living home that you would nurture and like everyone would learn the dynamics of their home. These are all individual organisms, the mutations that would occur, the co-evolution you would have with the organism you live inside. And I started thinking of like mitochondria in a cell. Now, mitochondria started off as an entirely different organism that was enlisted into the lipid barrier and became vital as like a powerhouse of the cell, and how this is very much a biological standard. And I love how you said that, that until we get over our obsession with eternity and understand that we are continually in the process of co-evolution with living things, then we can kind of pick up the mantle of, you know, biology again and kind of be the actors that other organisms have been for so long, which is constant co-evolution and mutual adaptation. And yeah, you start throwing out things like circuitry and autonomous bio-welding. I mean, we're just scratching the surface. Here, I thought we were mind-blowing just talking about materials. You're going way beyond that. You're talking about creating giant living actors that can fill roles in our life and by where we fill roles with them. That's an absolutely kind of inspiring worldview.
It's a spiral. It catches you and you don't get released. It expands.
I'm ready. I am ready for this vortex. And you know, I had questions about what do you think about, you know, maybe having mushroom lights, or I thought I was going to hit you with far out concepts. And you're already like, oh, of course, there'll be living lights and living buildings, and we'll just all kind of conglomerate into one biomass. The human will be indistinguishable from the mushroom mycelium at some point.
Most possibly so, yes.
In our highest form of evolution, we just have a mycelial human mat that covers the earth and is connected. I mean, we have the internet, we're talking about living buildings, you know, who knows how far away that future is, or if it's...
No, and the beauty of this soul somehow is that if you take this framework that we are now elaborating on together, what appears to be key to me is the notion of generation or regeneration, depending on how we want to put it. It's so key because in the end, there should be no man-made material capable of compromising human health and the health of the larger ecosystem. It shouldn't exist simply in our everyday. And as I generally tend to like saying, thinking regeneratively ultimately means to try and think as a transformative fungus would do, which is for nature, with nature, and as nature, in this constant process of collaborative, collective evolution, where everything is entangled. And it sounds perhaps, I don't know if it sounds simple or not, or if I'm making it too complicated. To me, it sounds relatively simple as a concept, but it's so difficult to implement. It's so difficult to make it yours. So this is what I keep working with, and I keep reminding myself, not just predicating, but I try to say it in order to listen.
Yes, well, I think of this concept, you know, our culture is very familiar. Many disciplines have this concept of entropy built into them. And I love the idea of syntropy, that we can embrace these concepts of cohesion that bring things together, and kind of a generative principle leading the way, instead of focusing on, you know, this entropic force. Yeah, I think once you get into it, we can see this come together. But yes, I think it's going to take these kind of folks like yourself going out and emerging in a framework where this organism that is Mogu, you know, how can this exist going on these far out, but you're finding ways to exist and thereby transform the ecology to maybe make this, you know, one massive part, but one small step really in the gradual transmission that we're going to have to that symbiotic or enmeshed existence with other bioforms. And you sometimes think, if, you know, the human brain, I don't know if you want to call it the ego, whatever that force is that differentiates us from the other, you know, maybe in the humans, it's kind of a, I won't say a handicap, but it's something that we will eventually subsume. And on the grand scale, you know, we'll forget this period where we saw ourselves as distinctly separate from other organisms and we didn't work with it. Man, take a couple million years. Like, oh, nothing even harkens back to the day when we were separate from mycelium and plants.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, I just to bring us back to the current reality, as much as I love that vision, Tell us what's going on with Afia, because we've talked about Mogu and we've talked about the acoustics and the products that are available. Where are we in the life cycle of Afia, and what is that company focusing on?
Yeah, actually, it's the same company. It's just yet another vertical. It's another business line of what we call today's Scheme. And so it's a business line, it's a brand, and it's a new class of products. It's a new class of materials, in fact. And this is something also, I mean, you see, things take time. And I started working with these processes, I think, for creating flexible materials. It must have been 2012 in the lab. I still have some prototypes of those here in the studio. And it took some time. You know, every single development that you want to go through takes a lot of focus, a lot of dedication. So it took some time to also internalize other type of processes beyond the one of, you know, growing fungi on lignocellulosic substrate to create composite materials for interior design, interior architecture, and so on. This is a similar process, but fundamentally different. And it's been incubated in our R&D lab for the past 3 to 4 years, I would say. But it very recently came to life in the open. Let's say it was released in the open. And again, it's a process, the one that used for creating Afia, that is very still about fermentation. It's about taking low-value substrates, but it's a different type of fermentation. And we have different types of techniques we are utilizing today. But let's talk, for instance, about the solid-state fermentation that we use. In this case, we developed a specific protocol which is combining the advantages coming from solid-state fermentation and submerged fermentation, so dynamic steered cultures with fungal biomass growing in liquid. And I think it's relatively simple what we decided to do, but we started developing basically a static reactor where our fungi could grow on top of a substance that exists in a phase between the solid and the liquid. And this allowed us to start obtaining very consistently homogeneous outcomes when it comes to the final pieces of raw living material, simply literally fungal biomass, 100% mycelium materials that we are able to separate from this nutritive terrain. And this became a little bit of the basis for creating this whole new class of products on the side, because we increasingly also in this case started learning about how to tweak the different parameters in order to inform structural changes, to inform a change in thickness of the material, but particularly to make the material reactive to what follows, to all the downstream processes. Because of course we come to 100% natural material, we harvest it from our static reactors, and that eventually gets dried, and it goes through a series of transformations. You know, very often people talk about, we call those materials Afia for a reason, but people refer to them as mycelium leather, mushroom leather, for the sake of benchmarking, because also they can have physical experiential properties that remind of. Now, it's not leather. It's a skin, but it's not an animal skin, and that is leather. It's a fungal skin. It's fundamentally made up of a different constituent as opposed to an animal skin made up of collagen. When it comes to fungal materials, they're mostly made out of chitin. Therefore, also the chemistry that you use for stabilizing the material and for making it inert and feasible for use in the industry is fundamentally different. It doesn't make use of any kind of heavy metal. It uses some chemistry, green chemistry, very advanced products, and very, honestly, very low impact, with a little impact though. There's always a little, inevitably, unfortunately, for the time being. And yeah, basically what we are able to do with such materials is to, because of their reactiveness to the process of transformation, we are able to morph them into a lot of different articles for different specific uses. So today we are mostly working within the fashion industry, the fashion market, for applications that relate both to ready-to-wear and to leather goods, so garments rather than wallets, bags, and the likes. The interest has been great also when it comes to shoes, when it comes to automotive, another sector we are working with increasingly, the furniture industry, of course, think about upholstery and such. To be honest, we are in a very positive situation where also the great excitement that happened to manifest during the past years, and who would have ever said when I started doing this job like more than a decade ago, there was a lot of skepticism towards this type of practice. It was like, what the hell are you doing? And then all of a sudden, everybody's talking mushrooms. And I'm like, wow, what's going on? That's fantastic. But I mean, this brought us to have the privilege to be approached by the most illustrious players in the fashion industry, the luxury holdings and all the brands that they incorporate. And in fact, we've been in the position to release a first announcement early March 2022, when together with we were finally able to announce, and that's the only one I can speak about until today, about the partnership we did with the Kering Group. It's a really large luxury holding as part of their fashion show in Paris for their winter collection 2022. And as opposed to what you mostly see, unfortunately, out there, where a lot of announcements are made and they're not followed up by effectively delivering the product that you never see in the market, I'm really proud, really, really proud to say that actually just in a few weeks from now, the coats will be in global retail shops. And that's super exciting. But it's not a point of arrival. It's just the very beginning. But it's just very important for me as an individual and for us as a company to be very concrete. And that's been our approach since the beginning. We speak about things when things are a fact. We do not want to ride this wave of sensationalism and to predicate about a future that is sold as a present. And eventually that creates a disillusion because everybody keeps saying, where is the stuff? And the trust is not there anymore. And so this is happening. This is really exciting. A lot more is happening and fermenting behind the curtain these days. And I'm actually, as part of the company, you read at the beginning my title, which I think it's quite a special title.
Chief Mycelium Officer.
Yeah. But that stands actually what I do as part of that title. I do direct the activities of R&D, of the R&D of Scheme that brings R&D both to Mogu and to EFEA, but my focus is particularly on EFEA these days and on all the industrialization. So today we're running a small pilot facility that's capable of producing very limited amounts compared to the market demand. And we are currently starting deploying our demo facility, which will be able to serve many more customers and also to make our process more efficient, which is, of course, at industrial level, what you need to increasingly do due to also the role of automation and the way in which, again, the operations are gonna change a little bit, are going to be quite optimized. But this is, for instance, yes, where we are today, and we are very frustrated about our limited scale. At the same time, we are growing pretty nicely. It's a much more conservative growth compared to the one of other entities in other continents. Again, we live a completely different business ecosystem in Europe. Let's say that it's very hard to receive a substantial amount of funding until you do not demonstrate that your paper business plan has reached the market and has worked in the market. So until then, you definitely need to work with very limited resources, but sometimes that is also something that pushes you to get the best out of the little that you have available. And that's for us a gift in the end.
I mean, that's a beautiful thing to hear. I often think that how limitations sometimes directly correspond to creativity and different breakthroughs. But I love that idea that you can go out and get that jacket. That was the question I had is... If you can afford it, of course, we are talking that, you know, these goods are going to be, you said that about the building materials too. These are going to be a bit of a higher price point, but I love that you can actually get it, because I know that's one thing when we talk about this. Yeah, we get in this cultural milieu of there's going to be a future where we have leather jackets. Oh, here's one on the runway. But then the fact that people can't touch it and use it still makes it seem like it's somehow behind, you know, a glass wall and we're not quite there yet. So I love that you focused on, hey, we're going to make this a reality. We're going to get this to the people. Yeah, that's a terrific ethos and guiding light. And I guess do give us an idea then of how big the company is currently. I mean, we talked about this is kind of incremental growth, very much grounded in, you know, proving out concept again and again and again before you can keep expanding. But where are you today in terms of personnel, production facilities? And then, you know, if you can tell us, how big is the new facility and what does that look like?
Sure. Now, today, all together, I'm talking Skim, including therefore also the Mogu dedicated team and the EFEA dedicated teams, we are counting on around 30 people.
In total. Small but mighty team.
Very small and very mighty. But based on the developments that have been planned and that we have been also raising funds for, within the next year will be three times as much, I would say. And also our facilities will change dramatically, but that touches both upon Mogu and EFEA. Let's say that Mogu will have certainly will be able to increase its production volumes, but also to have a more efficient line that today is quite manually operated still. And the same applies to EFEA. I made, just to give you a reference, today we are able to, I mean, we are fully supply constrained. We are not even a drop in the oceans. We are able to produce something like several thousand square meters of our EFEA material in a year, which is not much. I don't know how to turn it into square feet right now. But when it comes to the demo facility, we'll be able to do, let's say, 30 times as much, and that's just going to be a module. So the way in which we are scaling up is through quite an interesting modular way that is also cutting a lot of the infrastructure cost and the heavy kind of, you know, steel stuff in order to just make it also more economically feasible and more competitive from a pricing point of view of the final product. And we believe it's going to work. We've been testing these modules quite a lot. And working on such modular approach will allow us, I predict, to also scale quickly when it comes to the commercial phase. It's never going to be just about, okay, replace, you know, just multiply the modules and then you have the commercial scale. No, it's a little bit more complicated than that. But there is a very solid base once we will have fully validated the demo facility for scaling up super, super quickly. So that's where we're heading. And that's what concerns solid state. Of course, we are working also with submerged fermentation, so dynamic stirrers and so on. And in the sense, we are developing other classes of materials still in the flexible realm. And we rely very much on the technologies that are used already in the food industry and beyond for actually not extracting metabolic products, but for extracting biomass with specific products within.
Yeah, you would imagine kind of fermenters that you see at breweries or similar would be instrumentation that you guys could use. And is there any thought when you're placing these facilities? I love the idea of modular building infrastructure that can be deployed to an area. I mean, we're not quite, I'm imagining like a mycelium, living mycelium warehouse producing, and that's in the future for EFEA and Mogu. But is there any thought when you're deploying these modular cultivation facilities of, you know, supply chain and side stream? I know that's part of the overall vision, is to be able to incorporate agricultural waste, maybe be situated in an area that's advantageous to that. Is that part of that eventual plan, is to kind of deploy these in areas that make sense to, you know, near an ecosystem of agricultural waste, something like that?
What you describe is absolutely key, and that's very much part of our foundational values. It's like, I would say that even before working with fungi, Mogu was started based on the belief that it is possible to surpass the notion of waste, which we created, and to consider everything as a resource. To really rely on local availability of whichever type of residue rather than waste to valorize through, in this case, fungal fermentation. And this is what we do today. We strive for having most of our feedstock, which is low-value feedstock, is non-food stuff, and mostly often it's considered waste in the industry. So most of our feedstock comes from the surrounding area. Of course, we look for also consistency when it comes to availability in the long term. There need to be volumes. We are talking about industrial operations, so we need to be sure that that the supply is going to be there, but certainly we are not shipping our biomasses from China or from Canada. Worst case, we go Transalps, so we are actually, you know, north of Milan, close to the Swiss border. It's in the region of the lake. We are in the middle of nature, close to the Lago Maggiore, Lago di Varese, and so on. And sometimes our biomass maybe can come from France, can come from Germany, but always from very close by, mostly often from Italy. So this is a very important aspect. And that's also how we have been thinking about our factories as something that can exist, entities that can exist specifically placed in a locality based on the availability of a certain type of resources in that locality. And according to that, each new plant, say you start a plant in Vancouver or wherever, then you have to look what is available there and you have to adapt your process to what is available there. So perhaps the strain is going to be a different one. So again, it's not just about saying, okay, this is the protocol, now just implement it as you do in the chemical industry, for instance. No, it's not just about performing the protocol. It's about studying the conditions in which the protocol happens in order to make fully sense from a thoroughly integrated circular perspective.
I love that. It's contextualized in the ecosystem where you plan to deploy it, and you just said it. I mean, it might necessitate different strains, and this is where you would see that decentralized aspect of this idea, where if you're going to situate a facility somewhere, it might necessitate changes in variables, changes in strain. And I love the vision. I love the vision that you're laying out there. And the last question, I mean, I could ask a million more questions, but you were talking about...
But there's more. Just I think an important thing touching upon this subject is about also what happens with our non-waste. So sometimes we do have some biomass that didn't go well, or some production that unfortunately fails. It can happen. We are quite efficient, but not perfect today. And all such materials can be reintegrated within and valorized internally, either to feed new cultures and be supplemented in the needed way, made some nutrients have been depleted. So again, the material keeps circulating within the factory. Or today, for the demo facility, we are studying the possibility of using our spent substrate to produce biogas to run the facility. So the whole vision of the company is to truly make the most out of what people consider of no value. And so far it's working. And I hope we will be able to fully demonstrate it in the years to come.
Yeah, of course. The question is, what happens to your guys' waste? And I love that, turning it into biogas, using that material as a resource, not as waste. I'm going to change that in my own repertoire. And, you know, it's also hitting on this concept. I said decentralization, but this concept of localization, or, you know, this is something that I'm seeing a lot. I think globalization thrived strictly in an environment that considered economic variables and efficiencies. And I think now so many intelligent people I hear in design, whether that be municipal design, product design, they're very much coming back to localization and designing around local ecologies, both kind of non-human ecologies and human ecologies, and contextualizing whatever design or development you're going to do around that very local set of variables and constraints and things like that.
We must. We definitely must. I think it's not an option. It's a need.
Absolutely. And, you know, we just had to go all the way the other way and then see all of these negative externalities from that and realize we need to come on back. And the last question that I wanted to ask was about, you know, you said in the lab you're working with two strains primarily. So when we're talking about Ifea, when we're talking about Mogu, are we dealing primarily in this, and as much, again, understanding that we are in a kind of competitive economic framework, so say as much as you can, I guess.
Sure.
But are we using one or two strains to produce all these different products, whether it be kind of the static cultivation or an aqueous cultivation for flexible or durable? Is it just modulating different parameters for only a couple species of fungi?
So when it comes to production, today we use primarily two strains when it comes to Mogu and Ifea. When it comes to lab, it's more than that. I mentioned before, possibly around 10, maybe even something more. But yes, the products that go out and that are sold today are deriving from employing those two guys. That doesn't mean that there's more ongoing when it comes to other potentials expressed by other species and strains, but it takes time to make that be, again, it takes years for that to come into the production phase. And yet, yeah, I would say even when you consider the different types of fermentation methods that I described before, from the solid state when it comes to the complex substrates, so the fiber stuff, to the one with the hybrid liquid solid nutritive terrain, to the fermenter. Well, when it comes, for instance, to submerged fermentation and big tanks and so on, there we're working with plenty of different strains that are not necessarily the usual suspects of the Basidium icides family, but are also other fast-growing fungi that are typically employed for the production of enzymes or other metabolic compounds, but that we particularly like not necessarily for producing enzymes, but for producing biomass. And we are, in fact, approaching our processes with the intention of deriving from one single process multiple type of outcomes, so multiple values. One could be what is secreted in the media, one could be the biomass itself after purification, prior to purification, what do you extract, what you can do with this type of compound. And so it's really like a sort of biorefinery approach.
I mean, that's an incredible potential. You know, if you think about aspergillus strains and things we already use in biotech to get enzymes, to get compounds out of, and the idea that if you can find a protocol that lets you use the affiliated actually fungal biomass in addition to all those enzymes secreted in the media, that is a massive, massive, exciting potential. And just when you talked about the reason I wanted to hit on two species in production capacity is the amount of variability and the amount of potential just in those couple of species. Obviously, this is with different parameters, both in growth, but also different parameters in terms of kind of post-treatment, which I'm sure for the leather and things like that, I know there's probably extensive treatment processes that go on. But yeah, you just hit on that other concept where I thought, man, they could easily branch out into working with all kinds of materials and enzymes. And once you have the infrastructure to do extensive amounts of, you know, aqueous fermentation or solid state fermentation, suddenly it opens up the doors to all kinds of things that you can produce.
Indeed, different applications, different markets. So again, today the focus is and must be limited to, and it's already much, those two domains, let's say what we say called green building and, right. And let's say the alternative materials, flexible materials, alternative leathers, so-called. But the sky is the limit when it comes to fungi and when it comes to the applications you can target. And of course, there's the most usual ones that you can think about, you know, fungi as medicinals. So pharma developments as well, beyond tradition, also really coming. And we have so much to learn from whatever tradition in the Asian countries, so much wealth. We practice fermentation. And then I think about, my God, think about China, Korea, Japan, for how long they have been devoted to this symbiosis, because it is a symbiosis. And so plenty is yet to be unraveled to the benefit of the global population and possibly not a few corporations driving the technology. There's, of course, developments for the automotive sector, for the food industry, plenty of innovators out there, highly competitive field. We are also doing something in R&D about that. We are mostly developing ingredients for others. It's not product for us today. Right. It's more research we conduct. Perhaps it's going to become a vertical one day, but now we need to be focused. There is, of course, the beauty industry with all the cosmetics. And there is, for instance, the aerospace, which I find a very interesting application. I mean, think about the fact that our materials are extremely lightweight. Our alternative leather, so-called materials, EFEA, is much, much lighter than leather. And when it comes to aerospace, to aviation and so on, it's fundamental when thinking about logistics. Or something else that I did a few years ago was 2016. With the studio, I did a research together. It was a principal feasibility research project together with the European Space Agency and Utrecht University, where we studied the possibility of growing architectures on the moon and on Mars by transporting minimum amount of fungal biomass with a space shuttle therefore limiting the logistic impact, and being able to propagate that on another planet, provided, of course, availability of biomass. And that was stored within a kind of closed loop system where different kinds of organisms, including plant matter, would be cultivated. And it was very interesting because we studied, and it's actually we did this study really quite some years ago, and then NASA came out with something similar a few years ago, right. But they do a much better communication. They are, the European Space Agency is not really, it's also publicly funded, it cannot do advertisements, so it's a little bit more complicated. But if you're happy, I'll be happy to share also with the community this document. So basically, we started studying the behavior of fungi, specific fungi, in extreme conditions, you know, exposure to extreme temperature, moon minus 100 plus 100, exposure to cosmic radiation, gamma rays, rather than multiple stress, microgravity, macrogravity. And we did this at the facility of the European Space Agency in the Netherlands. And it was fantastic to see that actually fungi were just doing fine, and not surprising, to be honest, simply because then you might start wondering, well, okay, why is that? Now we are trying to bring fungi in space, but most possibly that's where they come from in the first place, right? and they have been the early colonizers. They landed on Earth, whatever the meteorite or whatever other thing having brought them here. And in fact, it's quite amazing to see that you can potentially, the principle was validated, you can grow architectures on planets with extreme conditions and shield yourself actually from gamma rays that would almost instantly kill you, because fungi can in fact pigment when exposed to a certain type of stress and produce melanin. And this melanin, in fact, is the same compound that protects us from UV rays, but they do it in a massive way. So this was just all validated, and I cannot wait for the time, for the moment in which my cultures will just enter the spaceship and go on the International Space Station. I hope one day that could happen.
Absolutely,
it's not my cultures, by the way. It's just fungi. It's their own.
Your collaborators and exactly. Co-workers and colleagues are going to go out there on the space station and protect people. And I think that's more, it's funny how much that's entered our cultural zeitgeist of somehow we know fungal organisms are going to be our key to doing anything in space. And, you know, I read a series of books that has been since made into a TV show here called The Expanse, and fungi feature heavily there, mostly as a food source. But it's so interesting, you know, to push sci-fi writers to think, look, these are going to be materials. Everything is going to be made out of fungus in space. We're going to have living buildings and structures. And maybe that will be the direction that writing starts to go. And I remember Phil Ross telling me about a sci-fi writer who wrote a book about space exploration, and people had a second skin made of mold or fungus. And people would then sometimes just become obsessed with their symbiotic partner and become what are called moldies and just float around communing with their fungal partners. And I think, you know, I was going to say, I think there needs to be someone on staff there at SKIM to keep Maurizio, like to hold him back, to like, all right, rein him in. We're giving him all these tools. He's going to become a moldie. He's going to just be symbiosing with these organisms. And I can just see in the way you're talking about it, it's like, yeah, it's tough to be able to kind of limit scope to fit in kind of the narrow boxes that we have now for development. So I laud you on that level of restraint.
Yeah, but you must. Actually, that's the biggest advice I would give to anybody willing to venture in this exciting yet challenging world. Find the focus, because you get so excited about everything, but at some point you need to circumstance your enthusiasm. I mean, keep it up, keep the enthusiasm very much alive, but just focus on something very clear, or otherwise it's going to be impossible just to derive something concrete. So yeah, focus, and listen.
Invaluable couple of pieces of advice I was going to ask for people who wanted to get into biomaterials. And I think that is fantastic advice for anyone interested in this field. Where, Maurizio, where's the best place, you know, for people to connect with? And we can put links to all the companies. We'll put the papers. All of that will be in the show notes. But any one place in particular to kind of connect to your universe, if there's one website or social media account to kind of stay up with all of these goings-ons and all the developments here.
Yeah, well, we have channels at the company level. However, what could be a good space? I'm running also this other entity. It's a completely different legal entity from which Mogu stemmed, but that's called Officina Corpuscoli. It's www.corpuscoli.com. And that's my Amsterdam-based practice. It's a small studio practice where we cultivate all such type of critical thinking processes as driven by very concrete experiments rooted in collaboration with fungal organisms. So perhaps that's both the physical space and the digital space where to engage with this type of conversations, thoughts, actions.
That's kind of that cutting edge that I think we wanted. So definitely we'll put that in the show notes as well to kind of connect, get it with these far out visions and experimental works. And then I'll just wrap us up with the three questions I like to ask all my guests. And the first one is just a mushroom or fungus that you love and why. And, you know, it doesn't have to be one that necessarily is in any products or doesn't have to be a favorite, but just one that you want to share with us, a mushroom or fungus that you love and why.
I find this question so challenging because I don't like rankings. So I would, for the sake of being inclusive, I always have a difficulty to say that's the best. But let's just mention one out of the many. And I take the reference to what I mentioned before, the so-called model organism that many are working with and that is widespread all over the world, called Schizophyllum commune. And I would say that besides, of course, that I find it really cute in terms of its morphology, its fruiting bodies. It's been very much the fungus that allowed me to learn more about this kingdom because it's the first fungus I started collaborating with, working with some specific strains from the labs of Utrecht University, where they are big experts when it comes to this specific organism and some specific strains, but that's in fact the reason why I'm mentioning it, because it's like some others, many others, it's a fungus that is said to have more than 20,000 sexes, which is amazing. Simply, if only we would recognize the incredible amount of diversity and nuances that are present all over in nature, among any kind of domain, among any type of living organism, in order to make that type of understanding our own too, and recognize that our limited binary view is not very much helping. And it's bringing me back to what I was talking about at the very beginning, about this divide, this pointless divide between nature and culture. If we are there to embrace our belonging to nature rather than talking about being surrounded by something, let's try and imagine better being immersed into something that we are continuously swimming in. And this substance, which is not just there, but there's much more to it. It's fully populated, it's very alive, it's thriving, it's loud, even if it sounds silent, it's really loud. And there's so much diversity within it. And it's astonishing to be mesmerized by that amount of opportunities and possibilities.
I was going to mention that about the split gill, and you just elucidated it beautifully, how it challenges notions of gender and notions of biological interaction and how we integrate that into human narratives will be very interesting. I have to credit Dr. Patricia Kashian and Jules Amanita, who is I don't like to use the word amateur because they are incredibly knowledgeable, but both Dr. Kashian and Jules Amanita greatly expanded my understanding in that realm. So it's great to hear you point that out. So yes, a fantastic reference organism and a fantastic fungus to get familiar with. And then what has this relationship with fungi given to you? And that's such a broad question, and I know we've brought up different elements of it, but to just encapsulate those thoughts and insights, maybe it's certain lessons, certain feelings, certain spiritual understandings, but as you've gone so deep in working with these more than human organisms, what has that relationship given to you?
Yeah, I feel very privileged by having had the chance to encounter fungi. I feel very grateful. I would have never expected, it's been a total surprise also to be caught in what I defined a few times as a very positive vortex. Why is that? Besides, again, the practical opportunities, and then you develop a business. Yeah, well, that's a part of it, but that's not what's been driving my interest. That's an effect. It's about the depth that you are able to gain for your own growth, for cultivating an understanding of or attempt to understand the most profound questions that regard your existence and the existence of anything that is. And basically entering in a collaboration and communication with fungal agents at many levels allowed for widening my perspective, for going beyond biases, for really surpassing what I believed were my limits. And this allowed me to start feeling increasingly humble to in front of all that I am part of, and yet feel connected to that whole, but not in control, or as much as in control as all the other agents, but the control is collective. So I don't know if I'm expressing it in a clear way, or if it can be clear at all. But yeah, I think that's what this encounter has been so incredible for, and so rich, incredibly rich.
You know, and I think you can feel that, you know, what you described as immersion into this existence surrounded by organisms and life and vitality and the collaboration that goes on all the time. You can probably reach that through other means or interacting even with other organisms. For some reason, fungi, mushrooms seem to be a talisman whereby so many people enter that kind of realm of collective consciousness. And I think they do that for so many people. And what better thing can a more than human organism give you than, you know, gratitude, humbleness, a sense of feeling immense privilege? I mean, what a enriching interaction to have with another organism to give all those things to you. And then the final question, you know, just to throw a little curveball, what kind of books or scientific papers have you been reading recently that have been inspiring you, or what have you been interested in, you know, when it comes to just media you're consuming, I guess, but I like books and science papers. So if anything stands out.
I would rather reflect on a couple of books that I've been reading recently. One that I failed to read a few years ago, and finally I was able to finish, being Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, an absolute must. I strongly suggest such reading to everybody, talking about also ancestral knowledge, talking about the richness of indigenous knowledge, the appropriation, colonization of knowledge, cultural colonization, and so on. So very, very, very important, as opposed also to books that in fact work more as manuals and that tend to take away from communities for the sake of making your own profit. And there are many out there that talk about radical indigenism, and I find them a little bit problematic. Other interesting readings, Design for the Pluriverse by Escobar, Arturo Escobar, also strongly suggested. I've been reading actually some botanical guidebooks and some foraging books, but because I'm just eager to learn plenty about it. And finally, the best way to learn is to be out and about and just be there. But of course, the books can kind of fit a little bit like your theoretical notions and gaps. And yeah, I would have perhaps some more. Of course, I mean, I could mention some, this is very, very straightforward, but The Mushroom at the End of the World, the fantastic Anat Singh.
Beautiful book.
Very important book as well. I'm not reading much literature lately, I have to admit. I'm reading a lot of essays. But yeah, that would be some of the suggestions I could offer.
Well, right there is really lifetimes of learning, kind of in all of those books, it sounds like. And I love Designing for the Pluriverse.
Yeah,
that's one I had not heard of yet.
Yeah, yeah. Please have a read. I mean, it's a great Arturo Escobar. So just please have a look. And I think that altogether, these books really allow to strengthen what we were discussing a few minutes ago, no, to ever, if you already have found a little bit of a resonance with a certain type of energy and sensitivity, it's such important writings that contribute to experience further how to be connected, how to feel connected, and how to be the connection, which is finally what fungi allow. It's like what they really allow us to do, not just to see the connection, but to be part of it. And this is just mesmerizing. Think about the mycelium, the way in which the mycelium works. It's very easy at times to find yourself in that parallel and to feel tremendously humbled by that sensation, to be the network.
Yeah, a magnificent insight. And it reminds me so much of the follow-up book to The Mushroom at the End of the World, just released by Michael Hathaway, What a Mushroom Lives For, which deals a lot with that being and understanding your place as part of that network. And I think it's a constant process of becoming, and in several generations, the humans that come after us will probably be that much deeper into these symbiotic relationships. So very exciting to just be part of this wave and get to speak with people like yourself. Maurizio, thank you so much for coming on the show and not only giving us a view into this industrial world, entrepreneurship and novel materials, but beautiful insights about worldview and philosophy, and sharing it all with an amazing Italian accent. That's so easy to listen to. You know, thank you so much for coming on the show and being so generous with your time. It's really been a privilege.
Such a blessing for me to be here. Thanks so much for having me, Kevin. Really appreciate it.